Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for May's Neurology Club webinar. I'm very pleased to welcome our speaker for today, European veterinary specialist in neurology, Jurjan Gendel. Thank you, Jurjan. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Me, Joe. I hope you're hearing me well. Thank you, everyone here. Thank you for attending this course about muscular dystrophy. Muscular dystrophy is actually, it's plural. It's a topic that I usually, I really enjoy because I used to work in a laboratory with dystrophic dogs. And this is a very interesting disease. Because of many things, because of the clinical signs and because of the application in human medicine. So to discuss about this, I would like to do a classic plan. We're going to speak about the disease with an introduction. Then I would like to teach you how to find out what kind of clinical signs you need to look for if you have a suspicion of dystrophic myopathy, the way you can make this diagnosis in your own practice, and the way to treat it. So first of all, let's speak about muscular dystrophy. So dystrophy, it sounds a bad word. You probably know this word from corneal dystrophy, for example. It comes from Greek that means bad or ill-nourished. So that means that there is a problem in the muscle, and the growth and the future of the muscle will be impaired. So it's a primary degenerative myopathy, and it's a genetic inherited disorder. So it's affected by a defect of skeletal muscle proteins. Lots of them are possible, but most of the time the main protein that is affected is the dystrophin, and we're going to speak about that. So it's called muscular dystrophies because actually it's several diseases that are all named muscular dystrophy because they are due to a defect in those skeletal muscle proteins, and they tend to have some similar clinical presentations. So I'm sorry, but we need to do a little bit of boring anatomy of the muscle. So it's probably a reminder, but it's good to have this as a to start, just to make sure that we are speaking about the same things. So on the left side of the picture, you will notice that there is a muscle here, and we're going to do some transverse section in this muscle. So in this muscle, you will notice that there are some fascicles. All these things here, here, and here. These fascicles are surrounded by a perimysium, and all this group of fascicles are surrounding by an epimysium. So now, if we look into a fascicle, you can see that actually a fascicle is composed of several muscular cells, and around them there is a collagenous tissue called endomysium. A muscular cell is called as well a myocyte. Inside the muscular cell, you have the cytoplasm, which is called sarcoplasm in the muscle fiber, and the cytoplasmic membrane is called sarcolemma. And here are depicted the nuclei that are all in peripheral of the cell body muscles. Now, from a molecular point of view, if you remember well your veterinary courses, you probably remember that to have the muscle contraction, you need some interaction between myosin and actin filaments. And to have a contraction of the whole muscle, you need to have a cohesion between actin and myosin filaments, and the sarcolemma and the extracellular matrix. And actually, this cohesion is made by a group of protein here until here. And their role is to make sure that you have a normal contraction of the whole muscle by only a contraction of the whole muscle cells. So the main important protein is the dystrophin. Dystrophin is an intracytoplasmic protein there that is bounding the actin to another big protein called beta-dystroglycan. In the sarcolemma, within the sarcolemma, you will see that there are other proteins called sarcoglycan, and sarcospan, for example. And outside the cells, you will notice that there is another dystroglycan protein called alpha-dystroglycan and another protein called laminin alpha-2, and that is directly connected to the extracellular matrix. So all this network of proteins are responsible for the cohesion of the muscular cells with the extracellular matrix. Now, we're going to discuss a little bit about dystrophin because it's probably the most important protein in this cohesion. The gene responsible to synthesize this dystrophin protein is located on the X chromosome. It has mainly a structural role that I've exposed to you, but it has as well a role in cellular homeostasis. A particularity about this protein that it's a very long, a very big one. It's probably one of the biggest in the body, which is 2.3 million of bases pair of in the DNA. So that's huge. You will find it mainly in the striated skeletal muscle, and it's not located in the smooth muscles. This protein is also present in heart and is also present in brain. To discuss about muscular dystrophy, I'd like to do a little part of history just to understand where this disease comes from. The first case is identified in humans, were suspecting in the 19th century in two young brothers that had muscular weakness. At this time, tuberculosis was an endemic disease, so it was supposed that actually this muscular problem was linked to tuberculosis. In 1852, a medic called Merion suspected a myopathy in a family in 8 boys. So because there were boys, because there were muscular weakness, he suspected that it was a muscular problem and a genetic problem. He supposed that it was due to sarcolemmal changes. So it was a very important report from Merion. A few years later, a French medic called Duchenne did a comprehensive phenotypic description. Some people will tell you that he hasn't done much more than Merion, but he has put a name on it. It's a French name, paralysie musculaire pseudo-hypertrophique, which means pseudo-hypertrophic muscular paralysis. Mr. Duchenne was very well known, very famous, and now he has given the name of the disease, which is called Duchenne muscular dystrophy in humans, but we're going to speak about that. We'll have to wait a century later for the identification of the mutated gene in humans, and very quickly later, a few years later, by Sharp, identification of the mutation in dogs. So actually, the genetic identification in the disease in humans and dogs was very quick. This disease is very, very important in humans. It's probably one of the best known disease in humans, best known single gene disorder, and the most common one. So it's a recessive problem. It affects only, mainly, male newborn in humans, and it's very frequent. One boy out of 5,000 can be affected by a disease. This disease is very important because it has a dramatic evolution. Boys will end up in a wheelchair very quickly, and they're going to die from several complications of the disease. There are several forms of the disease that has been described. The most common one is the Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and it's due to a null mutation of dystrophin. So basically, there is no dystrophin in the body. So it's responsible for the most severe form of the disease, and it affects mainly young boys. But sometimes you have a mutation in the dystrophin that leads to a present dystrophin, but that is only partially functional, and this is called Becker muscular dystrophy. It's a less severe form. Dogs can have a better life, and they are usually diagnosed when they are older compared to the muscular dystrophy. It's so important in humans that you know that there are many telethons that have been organized everywhere in the world to gather lots of money for the research, and it's probably a disease compared to cancer or AIDS, for example, that has collected lots of money for research. Muscular dystrophy also exists in animals, so it's very important to identify that, mainly from a research point of view. So mice, there are mice with muscular dystrophy, there are dystrophin deficient mice. The problem with them that you will probably never see them in consultation, and you will probably never do a diagnosis of muscular dystrophy in mice. If you do that once, I will be very impressed. But first of all, it would be difficult to make a definitive diagnosis, and secondly, they have actually a mild phenotype, so it's a good animal model if you want to describe the effects of some treatment from an histological point of view, but actually it's not a good animal model from the human disease if you want to see the efficiency of some treatments. In dogs, muscular dystrophy has been described in pets. Some owners have had dogs with muscular dystrophies, and because the clinical signs are as severe as in humans, some colonies have been created everywhere in the world, mainly from golden retrievers, to be the animal model of the human form of the golden retriever muscular dystrophy. It can, this disease happens as well in pets. You can have this disease as well in pets when that comes in your consultation room. But it is important to remember that we have colonies, and that's why we know a lot about that disease. Cats as well can be affected. It's rarer than dogs, and pigs mainly are used from a research point of view. Muscular dystrophy in dogs and cats, there are several genetic mutations that have been reported, and all the genetic mutations can affect either the dystrophin or another protein of the sarcolemma complex that we mentioned before. The most common form is the X-linked canine dystrophinopathy that has been reported in several breeds. This same form, X-linked feline muscular dystrophinopathy, has been reported in cats. So those two forms, the problems in the X chromosomes. But there were also other forms of muscular dystrophy that were described, like the alpha dystroglycan deficiency. So it's a deficiency of this protein here that has been demonstrated in Devon rex and in Sphinx. So very recently, the gene has been identified. It's been shown that it's a mutation of the COLQ gene that is responsible of congenital myasthenia in humans. Sarcoglycanopathies are possible as well in other breeds like Boston Terrier, Cocker Spaniel, Chihuahua, and finally, laminin alpha 2 deficiency have been demonstrated in cats. So that's why we speak about muscular dystrophies, because actually they are not all related to the same genetic mutation, but they are related to mutation to proteins that have a similar role in the muscular structure. So you will understand that probably the clinical signs might be different from breed to breed. So the breed reported with the muscular dystrophies, in dogs it's very difficult to make the list because you have several breed of dogs. And I've put here the main important one. So in bold, you would notice the dogs in which the genetic mutation has been identified. And the other breed are case reports of dogs with histopathological confirmation of the disease, but no identification of the disease. The golden retriever is always in the top of the list because he's the main model in human research for the treatment. But actually, you might probably never see one golden retriever with a mutation in your consultation room. In cats, this disease is common in domestic short hair and in some breeds like Siamese and Maine Coon. So it's not because many breeds are reported on this slide that it will be a very common disease. Actually, remember that it's a rare disease, but it's a rare disease that has been reported in several breeds. Just 1 minute to remember why mainly male dogs will be diagnosed with muscular dystrophy, with X-linked muscular dystrophy, just because this disease is recessive and linked to the X. So, for example, if we take those two beautiful dogs that will mate, so you have a male with normal X chromosome and normal Y chromosome, and you have a female with two X chromosome. One, the green one, has the normal form of dystrophin, and the chromosome in red have the mutated form of dystrophin. So because it's recessive, she is only a carrier and she doesn't show any clinical signs. And if they have a litter, a fourth of them will be normal and will carry both normal copies of the X chromosome if it's a female. The other female will be a carrier, and the two other male, one will be completely normal and one will have a single copy of the X chromosome with a mutated gene. So it will have the clinical signs of the disease. So this explains why you can have a dog with muscular dystrophy with normal parents and sometimes normal grandparents. So now that we know a little bit more about the disease, I would like to discuss about the clinical signs, because you will see that they can be obvious, but you need to see one to identify them. So to suspect muscular dystrophy, remember that the disease is mainly affecting male dogs if the mutation is on the X chromosome. You have a variability of the clinical signs within different species and among breed as well. For cats, for example, you will find more likely muscle hypertrophy compared to dogs, in which you will have distal muscle amyotrophy. It's a multisystemic disease, because everywhere you have striated muscles, you might have some clinical signs. So mainly you will encounter motor signs, but remember that you have striated muscular layers in digestive system, like the esophagus, for example, in the respiratory system, like the diaphragm, for example. And remember that we said that the dystrophin was present in the heart as well, and in the brain as well. In the brain, actually, it has been demonstrated that in humans they could have some form of dementia. It's currently under investigation in dogs, but probably it's more difficult to investigate that because they die sooner than in humans. So now, for the next slide, you will see a video, and I would like you to practice. So I would like you to take a piece of paper and a pen and to write down what you think is abnormal for these dogs, from a gait point of view, for a posture point of view, if you can look at their mentation, for example. So it will be a couple of videos. I will show them for 1 or 2 minutes. The first video are with puppies, and the second video is a quicker one with a dog that is a bit older. So let's start the video, and I will not speak. I will just let you look at the video and write down your findings for around 1 minute. Let's go. Alright, so we're going now to move to the next slide, and you will see another video. It's another. Oh, sorry. So it's another. It's a golden retriever now, so it's quicker. The dog is a bit older, but you will see a similar gait, but on an older dog. Maybe once again. All right, so now we're going to move to the next slide to discuss about the clinical sign that you've noticed. So first of all, we'd like to just to speak about the mentation. These dogs look completely normal from a mentation point of view, and most of that, they look very happy, just because it's not involving the central nervous system at all, and not the brain. So the posture. So you might notice that they tend to keep their legs, their pelvic limbs under their abdomen, and they tend to have some plantigrade and palmigrade as well. You might notice some muscle atrophy distally, and paradoxically, you might notice that there is some hypertrophy of the muscles, of the proximal muscles, especially the muscles of the neck. If you look at their gait is tetraparetic, so it's not ataxic at all. It's easy to understand because it's a muscle problem. There is no sensory problem at all. There is no problems involving the sensory nerve. So these dogs are not ataxic. They are not losing balance. They are just weak. So they are tetraparetic because they are weak, and they are tetraparetic and do short strides. If you want to do your neurological examination and you test for the reflexes, you will notice that they still feel everything, but some response like the patellar reflex might be decreased because of the atrophy of the muscles and the fibrosis of the muscles. They have some exercise intolerance. You see that most of them, even if they are very happy to move, they are panting. You will see that they have some kyphosis and lordosis posture as well, which could be used to could be due to the weakness, or as well because some atrophy of the paraspinal muscles. If there are dogs that have been exposed to the disease for a long time, some pressure shows can be noticed. So that are the main motor signs that you will find in those affected dogs. But believe me, it's not the most important one. The most important ones are probably the following ones. So these dogs can have some dreadful digestive signs. First of all, they might have regurgitations. They might have regurgitations because they have a megaesophagus due to the abnormal striated muscular muscle of the esophagus, and they can have hiatal hernia as well because of the diaphragmatic weakness. At the top of that, you can add some dysphagia. They can have some prehension dysphagia because they can have some lockjaw due to masticatory muscle fibrosis, and they can have very big difficulties to swallow because they have some tongue hypertrophy, some tongue calcification, and they can have a pharyngeal involvement of the disease. At the top of that, you might notice that these dogs have chialism due to dysphagia or megaesophagus. So digestive signs can be very prominent. But most importantly, they can have respiratory signs, and that can be life-threatening. You might notice that they have polypnea. This polypnea can help to compensate the difficulty of them to breathe. They have some weakness in the intercostalis muscles and the diaphragmatic muscles. So you might notice a paradoxical breathing pattern with dogs pushing on their abdomen when they do inspiration. And this could be as well secondary to aspiration pneumonia. Aspiration pneumonia is common in those dogs because of the very frequent regurgitation in dysphagic episodes. And at the top of that, remember they can have some heart failure related to the dystrophic form of dilated cardiomyopathy. So these respiratory signs can be very prominent as well. You have some dogs in which the clinical signs are less pronounced. We could compare that to the Becker form of the human muscular dystrophy. So it has been identified in some families of Japanese Spitz. We know as well that there are some Labrador Retriever that have some dystrophic patterns in the muscles, but are doing very well compared to other ones. In those mild phenotypes, you can have normal CK. We're going to speak about it a bit later. And the only way to identify this disease is to do a Western blot, and we're going to speak about that later. So I'll show you one of the patients we had quite recently. It's a 9-year-old Border Terrier that has always been fine before. So you will notice that the gait looks less severe compared to the poor puppies that we've seen before. But this dog is still a bit paretic. You might notice that it's difficult for him to move the shoulder and the proximal limbs, but he looks very happy. He looks fairly able to walk, almost able to run. And this dog is 9 years old. He hasn't had any trouble before. So that's a later form of the disease, a milder phenotype of the disease. So you have to be aware that they are not always severe forms. Muscular dystrophy in cats can be more difficult to identify because the clinical signs are usually less severe. You might notice a bunny hopping. I didn't mention that in dogs, but bunny hopping is a prominent clinical feature as well. They have progressive stiffness and a particularity of cats, and they can have distress syncope collapse induced by stress or by general anesthesia. So be very careful in cats when you do a blood test. If you know that they have muscular dystrophy, or if you're strongly suspecting one, because they might collapse. So now that you have all the keys to identify the disease, we're going to discuss about the way to make a diagnosis with this disease, because it's very important to try to reach this diagnosis. It's not very difficult. Everything could be done at your practice, but there are a few steps that you have to respect and in order to make a correct diagnosis. First of all, differential diagnosis. It's not with this gait that we'll say for sure this dog has muscular dystrophy. This gait is mainly evocative of a neuromuscular disease. I mean, a disease affecting either the nerves, the junction between the nerve and the muscles, or the muscle. But it's not 100% typical of a myopathy. To have our differential diagnosis, we know that in this patient, it's an early onset and it's progressively getting better. So now let's consider the disease that have the same kind of evolution. There is a form of congenital myasthenia gravis. So you remember that myasthenia gravis, it's a disease affecting the junction between the nerve and the muscle, and acquired myasthenia gravis is an immune-mediated disease. But there are some form of congenital myasthenia gravis with dogs that are weak. So that could be part of the differential. I think the most important disease to rule out in those patients is polymyositis due to protozoal infection in dogs due to Neospora. Neospora is a parasite that has a tropism for muscles and peripheral nerves, and puppies can be affected when they are when during the pregnancy, and they can show clinical signs very early. Stiffness mainly located to the back legs, with muscle fibrosis, very difficult to flex the legs. So these dogs could look like neosporotic dogs. They are puppies and it's getting progressive. And I think with now the tendency to have raw meat diet that we're going to see more and more dogs with Neospora. So definitely Neospora, you should keep an eye on it if you have this suspicion before considering muscular dystrophy. An immune-mediated disease can be suspected as well, but it's usually in older dogs. And finally, I would consider degenerative polyneuropathies in those patients. So what we would love is to, because it's a genetic disease, is you have your dog, you suspect muscular dystrophy, you do a blood test, you send it to the lab, and it tells you, I've identified the genetic mutation, and this is his disease. So it's not possible yet. It might be possible in the future with if you explore the whole DNA of the dog, but at the moment, we have only breed-specific tests. Remember that for each breed, a different mutation has been identified, and there are currently at least 9 different mutations. So if you have a suspicion of muscular dystrophy, maybe just Google the name of the breed to see if there is a genetic test for the breed. And go into, but at the moment, a golden retriever test is available, as well with Cavies, with Norfolk Terrier, and Landseer. So it's very useful because it will give you a definitive diagnosis if it's positive. It is inexpensive, maybe between £50 and £100 to do the test, and it's not invasive. You just need to bleed the dog and or to do a buccal swab, so that can be very useful. And you can use it as well for the breeder, for them to identify the carriers and to eliminate them from the reproduction. The main problem is, if you have a negative disease, you will not be able to exclude the disease. You will start back to the point that you have no diagnosis. So this test is useful, but you have to be aware of the limits of this test. So let's go back to the most easiest thing to do. And if I had to take only one test on a desert island to do diagnosis on the muscular dystrophic dogs, I would probably take the CK test, because it's a very specific test for that disease. So you will have an elevation early in life. That can be possible in the female carrier, but the most interesting thing is that the elevation of the CK is very, very, very high. It's most of the time higher than 10,000 IU per liter, and usually around 100,000 IU per liter. It's very, very high, and the only disease that could do that is neuromyopathic ischemia, I mean thromboembolism, for example, and the clinical presentation is fairly different. So if you have very elevated CK in a dog with suspecting muscular problem, think of muscular dystrophy. Be careful if you have an in-house lab, that your in-house lab may not be able to go up to a few thousand IU per liter. So consider doing a dilution, because it's important to know if your dog is more than 2,000, if it's 2,500, or if it's 200,000 IU per liter. It will considerably change your approach of this disease. ASAT can be elevated as well, but are not specific. You can have hyperkalemia. You can have inflammation patterns as well, because there are some inflammatory components in this disease. And finally, because you can suspect Neurospora or Toxoplasma, infectious titers could be an easy thing to do to rule out those disease before considering further tests. The next step, step that you could take during the diagnosis, would be doing chest X-rays. So chest X-rays are important just to confirm your suspicion of a neuromuscular problem, because you might see associated problems. Like this on the left, you will see a pretty good picture of hiatal hernia in these patients, and on the right side, you might notice the chest X-ray on the same dog, but there is a difference. On the chest X-ray on the top, you might not notice any clear change, and on the chest X-ray in the bottom, you will notice that there is a megalosophagus here. It's pretty obvious, and you will notice here a pattern, an alveolar pattern, compatible with aspiration pneumonia. And what's the difference between these two radiographs? One is on the left side, the other on the right side. So always do at least two incidents when you do thoracic X-rays, especially if you look for a megaesophagus, because the sensitivity of this test is not very, very good. Once you've done that, another way to try to identify the disease would be to do some electrophysiology. Unfortunately, in electrophysiology, you can't do that at your practice. You need some device and you need some experience to do that. But basically, it's putting a needle in the muscles. This needle has a plus and a minus, so we're going to identify some changes, some depolarization changes. If you put the needle in a normal muscle, you will have a normal trace, a flat one. If you put a needle on a muscle that is denervated or that has a myopathy, you will see some changes that are called abnormal electrical activities. And you can see, I will just show you an example of one on the video. So it's one of them that is called complex repetitive discharge. It has a sound that is very specific and that tells you that you have a muscle problem or chronic denervation. It will not tell you for sure that it is a nerve problem, for that you need to do some conduction nerve study during your electrophysiology, but at least you will know that you have a neuromuscular problem. Electrophysiology will help you to localize which muscles are affected, and it will be useful for the muscle biopsy. So then, now the next slide. MRI scan. MRI scan can be useful as well to identify if there is a muscle problem, but it's not an investigation that I would recommend. But you could identify that by accident, for example, because if you were suspecting a cervical spinal cord disease on these dogs, although they look more neuromuscular, but because you've seen that they were tetraparetic, you were considering a spinal cord disease, MRI scan will help you as well to see the muscles. And here on this slide, so you have a transverse section of the cervical part. Here you have the cervical spinal cord, you have the vertebra here, and you can here see that in some muscles you can see some hyperintensities like here and like here as well. So this mode is called STIR. It's a very good sequence in MRI to see some inflammatory changes in the muscle. So that could be useful to identify a muscular problem and to target the next step, that will be the muscle biopsy. So the main question that I have when I'm discussing muscle biopsy with vets is, which muscle do I take? So ideally, if you find some muscles that are abnormal on MRI or in EMG, you will privilege these muscles. If not, you are going to privilege the most accessible ones. I mean the triceps brachii here, the biceps femoris here, the gastrocnemius, the tibialis cranialis, and if you have some ticatory muscle atrophy, you can take the temporalis muscles. Ideally, you would consider taking at least two muscles in case one biopsy is not very talkative. And if you want to do only one incision, the best way would be probably taking the tibialis cranialis and the gastrocnemius muscles that are both on the same area around the tibia bone. Avoid doing an injection before doing that. If you have to do a premed, for example, try to do that in the paraspinal muscle rather than on the muscle that you want to biopsy to avoid any artifacts during histopathology. General anesthesia has to be considered, but please be careful for several reasons. So pre-medication, I would just recommend normal pre-medication with maybe ACP and methadone, avoiding alpha-2 agonists and benzodiazepines that could trigger muscular weakness. The induction can be tricky for two reasons, because it might be difficult to intubate because they have a locked jaw, you can't open the mouth, or because they have tongue hypertrophy that prevents you from correctly visualizing the larynx. So before you do your induction, what I would recommend is just to check the opening of the mouth. If you can't open the mouth enough to intubate, I would definitely you to recommend to refer the dog to a center when they have so endoscopy to try to do the intubation, but it might be very, very tricky. For the ventilation, to me it's mandatory to have mechanical ventilation to help this dog to have a correct breathing during anesthesia and to monitor capnography. So on the next slide, I will just show you a video. of one patient that has lockjaw. It was not a dog with muscular dystrophy, but with masticatory muscle myositis. And you can see that actually the mouth is not opening more than a few centimeters, which you can easily imagine that it will be very difficult to intubate this dog. Okay? So, next, I will just show you how to do a muscle biopsy. It's not very difficult, but if you've not seen the steps, it might be tricky. The most important ma part is not doing the muscle biopsy. Muscle biopsy is easy. It's more to know how to deal with the muscles. But first of all, I will show you how to do the muscle biopsy, but be careful. Try to prepare it. Something that it needs to be organized in advance. So you just choose where your muscle, which muscle you want to take. You do a skin incision. Once you've done your skin incision, you will see some subcutaneous tissue and some fascia, and you will see by transparency the orientation of the fibers. So you do your incision in the subcutaneous tissue and in the muscular fascia parallel to those fibers longitudinally. Then you will see your muscle, and the aim of taking the muscle would be taking this kind of volume, I mean a parallelepiped cube of half a centimeter, half a centimeter of the square, and then for the length, maybe at least 1 centimeter. I will show you now a video how to do that. Before that, yeah, I will just show you that what I do usually, I take some forceps after I've done my incision, and I use the scissors to take this little piece. Please be very careful with the forceps, because actually muscle pieces are very fragile, so it's very you can do some damage that can be seen in histopathology after that. So I will show you the video of the muscle biopsy. So it's just a skin incision, very easily. Then you do your incision in the subcutaneous tissue. It might be bleeding, but usually it stops. You don't need a bipolar to stop that, for example. Then you take your piece of muscle. So you see it's very quick, actually. Once you've identified your muscle, it is very quick. You just need a good general anesthesia. And then for the closure, it's a normal closure. I usually use simple suture. Sometimes you just need one or two stitches for the muscular layer, and then you do the subcutaneous closure and the skin closure as usual. So as you can see, it's pretty simple. Probably the most difficult part would be the next step, how to send it. So once you've done your biopsy, you cut your piece of muscle in two parts. One will be put on a swab with some drops of saline, not too much, maybe 3 drops no more, and the other one will be put in a formalin pot. The piece of muscle in saline is very important because the muscle will be frozen to test for different parts of the muscular metabolism, and this can't be done in formalin muscle. That's why you need both of them. You need to store in 4 degrees, and you need a 24-hour transportation in a laboratory that is able to deal with muscular dystrophy. So usually you do that in the beginning of the week to avoid the weekend. So which laboratory? I would recommend international one that are very useful for muscular dystrophy, because you will see that they need antibodies. So the most famous one, probably the one that has published a lot about muscular dystrophy in pets, is the Comparative Neuromuscular Laboratory, which is a US one. So you will have to organize a FedEx transportation, an overnight transportation to do that. It's feasible, but I would recommend you to go to the website of Professor Diane Shelton. You will see many useful information on how to do that, what kind of papers you have to put on for the border, etc., etc. There is a neuroscience center in Munich as well, led by Professor Kaspar Matiasek. The best thing is to contact him to know how to send the muscles, but it's definitely possible to send them there. It's probably closer to than in the than the US if you are in Europe. Please consider that you can have some weekends and bank holidays. So always do that in the beginning of the week and consider the problems that you might have with the customs when you send animal products overseas. The pathology features. What you will notice when you do histopathology is muscle fiber size variation with muscle with degenerative fibers and regenerative fibers. So here, for example, you can see that there are necrotic fibers around there. You will see here that you have some fibrosis as well associated everywhere, and you will see that there are some nuclei here that are probably inflammatory cells. So it might be sometimes very difficult to make the difference between inflammation and dystrophy because you have some inflammatory cells. So that's why you need to do some immunohistochemistry. Here, for example, you have a control muscles in which an antibody against dystrophin has been put on the control muscle on a normal dog. So you can see that you have some nice immunofluorescence on this control muscle. That means that dystrophin is here. And on a dystrophic muscles, you might notice that dystrophin is absent almost everywhere, and you can just only see a few areas where dystrophin might be present. So an interesting thing that you can do that actually with most of the proteins that we mentioned earlier, dystrophin, lamin alpha 2, utrophin, sarcoglycan, almost everything. So it will help you to do a better characterization of the disease. So here's an example of a full study on a dystrophic patient and a control one. So it's not available at all everywhere. You need to be on these specific laboratories. And this image comes from the Comparative Neuromuscular Laboratory that does a great job with this immunohistochemistry. And finally, if you want to go further before genetic testing, you can do a Western blot to analyze which proteins are normal, present, and abnormal. So in the end, you know exactly what the problem is in which protein. So you might not need everything to do a diagnosis on a PET, but if you are interested in this disease and if you want to identify the name of the disease, these labs can do that for you. Unfortunately, the prognosis is not very good for these dogs, especially for the absent dystrophin forms. It's a degenerative disease. It's a progressive disease that might be painful, especially if they stay unwell. They can have some respiratory issues, digestive issues, and in the end, they are not able to walk. Most of dogs tend to die after a few months, and some dogs can be 1 or 2 years old, but it's data from dogs in colonies in which vets are trained to keep them alive and in excellent condition. Cats, it's unpredictable because you have some sudden benign fall, just a reminder that they can have respiratory distress if you're not very cautious during their manipulation. So now that you've made your diagnosis, shall we discuss about the treatment? So no spoiler, but there is no treatment for this disease. There is no established treatment in humans, so there is no treatment in pets. It's a progressive disease. There is no current treatment. Dogs will never get better. So euthanasia has to be concerned unless you have very demanding owners and dedicated owners. So we tend to keep them alive to treat them just for research point of view. So in this case, it will be only a symptomatic treatment. So two aspects, treating the clinical signs, symptomatic treatment, and treating the disease. So it's more from research. It's not available to pets, but we're going to speak a little bit about it. So how to treat it? First of all, treating the recurrency problems. You need a comfortable. I would recommend doing a vet bed for that, for example. You need experienced nurses as well, because it might be difficult to have this dog hospitalized and they need to be used to deal with those dogs. If the owners keep the dog at home, they need to be taught how to use the bed, how to deal with the food. You need a rice bowl, for example, how to change recumbency, and to weigh dogs regularly to see if they are not losing weight because they are not eating very well, for example. These dogs are not incontinent usually, so that might be only the only good news. Physiotherapy could be done with several devices like help them up or slings or this FitPose peanuts. I've shown you some videos. I will show you quickly what kind of movement that you can do. So the passive range motion on this dog, for example, to prevent from the fibrosis, to do some ankylosis on these muscles. So you do that with all the articulation. You could do that with the full length of the limb. Usually dogs are very compliant with that, but if you have fibrosis and ankylosis, that might be a bit more difficult. The owners have to be that at least several times a day. I will show you now another video of some tonus exercise that you can do, especially with the peanut accessory. So it's used to improve the strength of the muscles on this patient that might be stiff. So actually you are supporting the body with the peanuts, and it helps for the tonus to improve on all the back legs. So it's very useful to any dog that have neuromuscular problem. Dysphagia regurgitation, you know how to deal with that, especially if you have a dog with idiopathic meningoesophagus, and you probably have seen this YouTube video before with this amazing chair and this dog that is used to use his chair every day. So it might look very good for this myopathic dog, but unfortunately remember that they are very weak, and it might be very difficult to do that. So you can use omeprazole to try to decrease the pH of the stomach. Sizapride, I don't know if it's useful because the muscles are not in not completely normal, so I'm not using it in those patients. So we stop the video. Dysphagia regurgitations can be managed if you use a PEC tube, or that you can do with gastrostomy and gastropexy. A low profile feeding tube can be used as well. You will need a high quality tube, and that needs very high care. So we recommend that only for dogs for research purposes, or with very dedicated owner that happy to go and see you every day. It might be difficult to manage at home. Some surgeries could be done to try to decrease the reflux. It's called fundoplicature. It's not very well described in dogs. It's described in children. It can be done along with the PEG tube to try to decrease the reflux, but it's not currently done in pets. Aspiration pneumonia can be life-threatening. So the clinical signs, sometimes you have just a dog that is waiting, that is losing weight. You can have some pyrexia, lethargy, cough, and dysorexia, and this can be identified with X-rays. The treatments, ideally you should base your antibody therapy on a bronchoalveolar lavage and a culture. If not, you can use, for example, large broad-spectrum antibiotics like amoxicillin clavulanate, and at the top of that using metronidazole. Oxygen therapy might be considered in those patients that have recurrent aspiration pneumonia, euthanasia as well, of course, if they are in pain or in respiratory distress, and the PEG tube should be advised if there is no other option in the owners or people want to keep them alive. So now, just a few slides to know what is done currently to try to treat this disease. The main problem with that disease is that it's a very big protein. Dystrophin is a very big protein, so the RNA is very long, and that might be difficult to use in a virus. First of all, let's speak about exon skipping. So you have your RNA with a stop codon, and this stop codon leads to an abnormal protein that is absent or not useful. So one goal is to put anti-oligonucleotide there that will bridge this codon stop, so you will forget this part. So that's why it's called exon skipping. You skip the exon, and in the end you have a shorter, maybe, but a functional protein that might be useful. Another way, another approach to treat the disease is using viruses that would modify the patient genome. So you have your dystrophin gene, and ideally you would put a normal dystrophin gene in the virus, but it's too big. So our researchers have created a microdystrophin gene. It's a smaller gene that contains only the necessary nucleotides that are useful to synthesize the protein. You put this gene in adenoviruses, and then you put these adenoviruses into the dogs. And hopefully this dystrophin gene, normal dystrophin gene, will go into the muscular cells and contaminate the DNA with normal dystrophin gene and hopefully restore. So it's working well in mice. It's not working well in dogs, for example, or in primates, because they have a human system that usually fight against the virus. Finally, there are some cells therapies, stem cell therapies with different kinds of stem cells, myoblasts, mesangioblasts, and iPS. These diseases so tend to be cultured. These cells tend to be cultured with a normal genome function and injected systemically or in the muscles. So it might be more useful in patients that have a more advanced disease. But actually, it might be very difficult to culture myoblasts and mesangioblasts from their own patients. So iPS is at the moment one of the stem cells that are more investigated because they are pluripotent and because they are easier to culture from the patient. So they are autologous grafts and they are not rejected by the immune system. So in conclusion, muscular dystrophies are severe disease affecting both humans and pets. So I hope now that you're aware of that. I hope now with this presentation that you're able to recognize the clinical signs. I hope now that you will be able to do muscle biopsies that are necessary to make the diagnosis and to send them to appropriate laboratories. I hope now that you know what kind of symptomatic treatment you could do to help those dogs for the few months they have if they have a good quality of life. I hope now that you know that genetic tests can be useful but are very limited. And I hope now that we are going to cure muscular dystrophy in the future in our pets, but most importantly in humans. Thank you for your attention, and I would like to thank my colleague, Professor Stefan Blow, that has given me the videos of these cute puppies, Professor Diane Shelton for some of the images of the from her laboratory, and Laurent Garosi from the video of the muscle biopsy. I would like to thank the Davis Therapy Fitness Center that for the videos of this neuromuscular patient. And I would like particularly to thank the French Telethon, AFM, that is doing a lot for the disease. Thank you for this intention, your intention. And now if you have some questions, I will be happy to answer it. In the future, don't hesitate to email us, and I would be pleased to answer any of your questions.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank you, Lean, for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the Members Air Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.